Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the head of the DPS promises state troopers no one will lose their job after Uvalde. It's been a year since permitless carry happened in Texas, and shootings have gone up a lot. And voter registration data shows that Democrats could break their losing streak in November. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Calls for accountability continue after the school shooting in Uvalde that left 19 students and two teachers dead. But the Texas Department of Public Safety is deflecting, and new reports show that DPS Director Stephen McGraw said no one is losing their jobs over the response to the Robb Elementary shooting. Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez represents Uvalde. He's been critical of the DPS response.
I know that as McCraw wants to suggest that he was only talking about one employee. It just seems to me that this has just been one continuously fraught narrative from the Department of Public Safety, pointing the fingers constantly at different people, constantly getting divergent messages, constantly misinformation. It has become very apparent to me that the Department of Public Safety should not be investigating themselves and should not be investigating this investigation. And at some point, as I've said in my statement, I really believe that it is time for Director McCraw to resign his position as the head of this agency after so many years of being there. I've lost all faith and confidence in him.
In your statement, you call this a sham investigation. Is that because McCraw's making promises before the investigation was complete, even though he had been able to see the videotape of the hallway? He knew everything that went wrong, and yet he's saying no one's getting fired.
Yeah, I mean, for him to 2 weeks ago, apparently, tell his internal crew, his internal leadership team, that no one's getting fired here. He's drawn his own pre-conclusions, if you will. And then this week, they suggest to us that five people are going in front of the inspector general. I'd like to know what he thinks is going to happen from that. As you know, David, the inspector general gives its recommendations back to the director, and then director then formulates his decisions as to what he's going to do with his employees. This wouldn't hold water in any big city in Texas. It wouldn't hold water in San Antonio with our chief of police, or in Houston or Dallas or Austin. We cannot let the guardians guard themselves. And that's what this governor and others have done by allowing Steve McCraw to conduct his own internal investigations. I have asked Abbott as recently as 4 or 5 weeks ago to take this out of the hands of the Department of Public Safety, to have the House, have the Senate investigate them. I've asked the Lieutenant Governor directly to investigate the Department of Public Safety, and that simply has not happened.
We're still not getting answers about what happened during the shooting. We've asked for public records. We've been denied by Attorney General Ken Paxton, looking for the 911 tapes and the recordings of police dispatch that day in Uvalde. Do you think that we would get more information? This is in the public's best interest to be able to access that. And why are they blocking that, do you think?
Well, it's obvious that this memo was leaked internally, so there's obviously discord within the organization. I urge every good, honest person working within the Department of Public Safety to continue to whistleblow against this agency that has gone, quite frankly, rogue. We've got a district attorney telling us that this investigation is going to take 2 to 3 years. The CNN article today suggests that McCraw is suggesting that it will take 2 years. We are in the year 2022. We have access to all of the technology, and more importantly, we just have human power that can look at the videos, look at the body cams, listen to the radio transmissions. We could have made and probably have made a very, very good understanding of what went wrong within the first week. And yet this department has chosen to hide all of this from the public of Texas. My only assumption could be that they are protecting this governor into this November the election, because they've acknowledged that the entirety of this force on scene was from Operation Lone Star. The same Operation Lone Star that this governor likes to tout so much failed these children, stood in a hallway for 77 minutes, did nothing, and now here we are 90 days finally looking at a few people. And 2 weeks ago, their deputy director, their boss, tells them all, relax, don't worry, no one's going to get fired here. We'll give you a slap on the wrist.
Thursday night, there was a shooting in Uvalde. It's been reported that it was a gang-related shooting. Governor Greg Abbott is saying he is going to be sending troops to Uvalde to investigate and to track down these gang members and deal with that. What is your reaction to how he's handling this?
So I have a message for Greg Abbott. Nobody in Uvalde trusts the Department of Public Safety. And so apparently he's just simply not in tune to what's going on or what happened yesterday on this KXAN story or now the subsequent CNN story. But the facts are the public in Uvalde has made it very clear previously about their feelings about the Department of Public Safety. And I can imagine after the revelations of last night and the revelations of this morning, and as that story begins to unfold, that they are going to feel less and less confident about an agency that was part and parcel of the failures in Uvalde, Texas. The real message that this governor should be talking about, if he knew what happened yesterday, that most of those kids yesterday were juveniles, is we need to have a discussion on access to guns of young people less than 21 years old. And this governor refuses to have that discussion because I don't know why.
Open carry, permitless carry, handguns went into law a year ago. It was at 21. Now a federal judge rolled it down to 18. We have not heard from Ken Paxton, the attorney general, or not if he's going to appeal that decision, even though in that federal judge's ruling, he wrote that it would probably win on appeal. And have you heard anything about an appeal on that?
I certainly would urge the attorney general to do the right thing here. I have not heard that he's moving on it. I think it's very disturbing if he doesn't. Clearly to me, it begins to even smell even more so of a top level leadership in the state of Texas that refuses to even accept, to even acknowledge that we have laws. There's a judiciary and there's a legislative process. Ken Paxton knows damn well, as so does this governor, that ruling is unconstitutional. That ruling's assessment that the laws are unconstitutional is wrong. NRA 1, it was a decision taken to the Fifth Circuit, plus NRA 2, a subsequent decision. Both of those said the age limits were appropriate. Those decisions were appealed to the United States Supreme Court, who rejected those hearings, those cases. Greg Abbott knows this is constitutional. Ken Paxton knows it's constitutional. And they know that that district court opinion is wrong and that they have both refused to act on this. So they care more about guns and the people that sell them than they do about their own constituents.
So these findings, these news stories that are coming out about the DPS and no one's going to get fired and how they've actively shifted the blame to the local police and deflected it from themselves. Abbott saying he's going to send troops into Uvalde to find these gang members. How does that, because you've had a lot of contact with family members impacted directly by the shooting at Robb Elementary. How do you think they're processing this? What are they hearing?
I had one of them text me last night asking me what legislation I would be filing in the spring, and he was hoping that we would be able to have a good discussion on that, which, of course, I've talked to many of them personally. We will be filing a tremendous amount of legislation on guns. Whether Republicans want to have that discussion or not, David, they're going to have to be confront families from Uvalde week after week in the legislature, in their hallways, at their doorsteps, asking them to do something. And what these families are asking for, David, is not the moon and the stars here. They're asking for reasonable, common sense gun solutions that the vast majority of Republican voters agree with as well. They're asking for an age increase to 21 on long guns, on assault rifles. Quite frankly, that's not this far liberal position of banning weapons, which we probably should consider at a federal level for sure, banning assault rifles. But we live in the state of Texas, and we get it. We understand it. And certainly those constituents are asking for that. Republicans this spring are going to have to answer to these families. We're going to have meaningful discussions on guns. And if they refuse to do so again, then God help them.
Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez, a Democrat, represents Uvalde. Last year, a new law went into effect that allows any adult without a felony to carry a handgun in public with no training and no permit. Since then, the number of mass shootings in Texas rose 62.5%. That's according to data analysis by Jeff Rauner. Rauner is a freelance journalist for Reform Austin News.
In the 1 year period before the bill was signed, 187 people were either killed or injured in mass shootings in Texas. That's from June 13, 2020 to June 13, 2021. That's when the bill was signed. Afterwards, in the 1 year period, 375 people were killed or injured. That's a 100% increase. And even if you take out Robb Elementary, in which 40 people were killed or injured, it's still a 79% jump. That's just an enormous jump. One of the other things that really bothers me when I was going through the data was this. Most places don't tabulate it by state. So you're control F-ing your way through a document and counting as you go. In the 1 year period before the bill was signed, you look at mass shootings, which are generally defined as four or more people. And you control F your way through it. It goes four, four, five, four, six, four, lots of fours. In the 1 year period after, there's a distinct jump in the bottom number of shootings. It goes more like 5, 5, 7, 10, 4, 5, 7, 20, that sort of thing. So more people are dying in these mass shootings on top of there just being more of them. I don't think you can draw 100% conclusions from the law. After all, the 1 year period before the shootings is during the darkest days of COVID, lots of people were still quarantining, so that could certainly be a factor. We may be seeing a normal jump in violence as more people return to regular society, but there's no getting around the fact that lots more people were shot in the time since Abbott signed the law.
What is your source for your control F, your control find process?
Generally, Wikipedia keeps a very nice and constantly updated mass shooting level. Those are drawn from Stanford University, the Mass Shooting Project, Vox has a gun violence archive, Mother Jones, Washington Post, the FBI, public data is also there, and the Congressional Research Service. The thing about mass shootings is this. They represent a very small fraction of overall gun violence, especially if you add in suicides on top of that. But because they almost always make the news, they're very easy to track as opposed to gun violence across the board. So even though they're not representative of all gun violence, they form a very nice baseline for you to see changes in trends, and they're very accessible by the public.
State of Texas does not have a tracker for gun violence?
No. I mean, you got to remember, for the last 2 decades, it's been difficult, if not impossible, to have a basic government database on gun violence, gun ownership, even suicides. There were laws against it. The CDC wasn't even allowed to research it in case it might someday lead to some form of gun control. So there's been very little appetite for creating databases that would let us know exactly what's happening. In general, you have to go through media reports.
Right. There should be a database from police reports.
Yes. All shootings should be entered in some sort of accessible national database that researchers and journalists can use so that the public can be informed and so that the public can make decisions based on data rather than a story they heard about somebody shooting a couple of intruders and deciding that that was the norm. Those things might make good news copy, but they do not represent the vast majority of what happens with guns in this country.
So there are people who will argue that correlation is not causation. They say, well, yeah, there are more shootings, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was as a result of this new permitless carry law.
The answer is always more data, more studying, more funding to look into the issue, and more willingness to do something when you get it. People who say the causation and correlation are not necessarily linked, I agree with you. There needs to be more research on the matter.
Jeff Rauner is a freelance journalist for Reform Austin News. Texas is home to a sizable number of members of the Oath Keepers, the far-right extremist group. And Texas has the most members who are elected officials, law enforcement officers, or members of the military. This is according to the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism. Mark Pitkavich is the senior research fellow at the ADL Center on Extremism.
The Oath Keepers are a large anti-government extremist group that's about a dozen years old, and they're one of the largest groups within the militia movement. And we've tracked them since they originated and have done different studies and reports and on them. But last year, a membership list was leaked onto the Internet that contained names and other data for people who had at one point or another paid dues to the organization between 2009 and 2018, and there were about 38,000 names on this list. And so what we wanted to do was to go through that, analyze that, and especially try to find people who were in, you know, sensitive positions, military, first responders, police, public officials, areas like this, to try and understand how successful the Oath Keepers had been in recruiting such people.
The dues that you mentioned, like how much are we talking about at per person and overall?
I mean, the dues were not very high. You know, most extremist organizations don't require members to pay dues at all. The Oath Keepers did, and they also, throughout their history, have consistently tried to raise money. In part, this is because the leader of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, became what you could call a full-time extremist. And to do that, he needed to support himself by money from the members, basically, people who were willing to give him money to do what he was doing. And so for the Oath Keepers, fundraising has always been, part of what they do.
Stuart Rhodes, people might recognize him. He has the eye patch on where he shot himself in the eye. He's also been charged in the January 6th insurrection. He could face life imprisonment. Latest news about him is that he's had a falling out with his attorneys. What is it about the Oath Keepers? What oath are they saying that they're keeping?
Well, the hook that the Oath Keepers use to recruit, and they particularly try to recruit from current or former law enforcement, military, and first responders. The hook that they try to use is the oath that such people take to uphold the Constitution. And the notion is that if you become an Oath Keeper, you refuse to obey, quote-unquote, unconstitutional orders. Of course, that's unconstitutional by their own particular definitions of what is and what is not constitutional.
This list that you've provided and you've gone through shows that we have people in law enforcement, elected officials, people in the military in Texas who have paid dues into the Oath Keepers. Is that a violation of anything? Could they face some sort of sanctions for doing this?
Well, it sort of depends from place to place. A number of police departments have codes of conduct that prohibit membership in extremist groups, and even in others that don't have such codes of conduct, there could be grounds for being fired for being part of an extremist group. But it's not uniform. And certainly the military has regulations that prohibit involvement with extremist groups.
So what are your concerns?
Well, I think it's important to note, you know, the Oath Keepers are, first, part of the militia movement, which itself has a long history of lawbreaking and violence, including terrorist acts and plots. And the Oath Keepers themselves have had members who have gone off and committed criminal acts, including acts of violence. And not least, of course, the fact that, as you noted, a number of Oath Keepers were arrested and charged with some of the most serious charges to come out of the January 6th insurrection, including Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers, and the Oath Keepers, more recently, the Oath Keepers' acting leader and main attorney, who was also arrested. And, you know, this is not, these are extremist groups that have extreme agendas and have members who are willing to, some members at least, who are, you know, willing to ignore the law, to break the law in order to, you know, achieve their agenda. And so we have to be concerned when people like that are in positions of responsibility. Someone who is in law enforcement has access to sensitive information. They can make decisions about arrests or investigations based on what position they may hold. They can leak sensitive information. Even like first responders, which people don't necessarily always think of as sensitive positions, are often part of Homeland Security initiatives and also have access to sensitive things. This is an older incident. But there was a fire lieutenant who was part of a West Virginia militia group that wanted to blow up an FBI fingerprinting facility, and he was able to get access to the blueprints to that facility. And so all of these areas are sensitive areas, and people who have extreme beliefs and extreme ideologies should not be given such positions of responsibility.
Mark Pitkavage is the Senior Research Fellow at the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism. The Supreme Court's decision to overturn abortion is motivating women and young people across the nation to register to vote for the November midterms. But what about in Texas? Tom Bonnier is the CEO of Target Smart.
What we've been looking for in this analysis, something that was really inspired by the results of the Kansas election early August, which, you know, somewhat surprisingly saw the pro-choice position not only succeed, but succeed by a very wide margin. And in analyzing that, we saw that it was really driven by this massive surge of women registering to vote, and in that case, participating in the election. So we sought to replicate that analysis around the country to see, are we seeing women registering to vote at higher rates after the Dobbs decision, which happened on June 24th. And what we found is generally the answer is yes. In Texas, the immediate data was interesting because it showed no real change in terms of a gender gap. In Texas, prior to the Dobbs decision, women accounted for about half of voter registrations. And when you look at the new voter registrations in Texas since the Dobbs decision, it's almost identical, 50-50. So at face value, it would seem that the Dobbs decision didn't really have an impact on the voters in Texas. But we looked a little bit closer at the data there and actually found that there were significant differences between the types of voters who are registering to vote after the Dobbs decision when you compare it to before. Biggest difference was in the sense of younger voters and from a partisan perspective. So when you look at the new registrants and see how many of them are under the age of 25, prior to the Dobbs decision, about just under 30%, 29%, of the new registrants this year in Texas were under the age of 25. Since Dobbs, that number's gone up to 37%. So an 8-point share increase, which is substantial. But that's accompanied by a surge in Democrats registering. Now, of course, Texas doesn't offer party registration, so we build models of likely partisanship for each individual on the file, and that allows us to compare between voters and across periods of time. And what we can see is when you look at the younger voters I'm sorry, if you look at all of the voters who were registering in Texas prior to Dobbs, Republicans appeared to have an advantage. Based on our modeling, the Republican advantage among new registrants in Texas prior to the Dobbs decision was about 5 points. Since Dobbs, we're seeing that swinging in the opposite direction, where Democrats have a modeled advantage of 10 points since Dobbs.
When it comes to voting, there's a concern about voter enthusiasm. Even though you only get to vote once, your enthusiasm does become important, particularly when we make voting difficult, and getting registered to vote also is difficult in Texas. And it's been identified as the toughest state to register and to vote in. So when you have strong voter enthusiasm, does that mean that these voters are more likely to go to the trouble to register to vote? And Texas is, you have to register way in advance. And then they actually get to the polls, and in Texas they make that difficult as well.
Yeah, voter enthusiasm is really the big question I think we're all asking at this point, is which groups are going to be more energized and engaged and therefore more likely to turn out. And we generally do see a very strong correlation between that level of engagement and enthusiasm and actual voting. And in fact, there's no stronger correlation than actively registering to vote and voting. What we find is, if you look at past precedent, if you look at prior elections in Texas and really around the country, that those voters who actively register to vote actually have a higher turnout rate in the subsequent election and the next election than those voters who have already been registered for some amount of time. And so there is reason to believe that these new registrants overwhelmingly will vote in this election. I think the other important factor here is that there's generally a strong correlation between surges in intensity and enthusiasm among a group that that is surfaced through voter registration and intensity in that group overall, meaning the relevance of this surge in new registration isn't just to suggest that we'll see a lot of first-time voters coming out in this election. Generally, first-time voters, even in a high turnout presidential election, account for a relatively small share of the electorate. But what past precedent tells us is it's likely that you'll see more of those voters in general coming out. So the data in Texas, the voter registration data showing this surge of younger people registering to vote as we get closer to the election, would seem to suggest that we will see an increase in voting among younger voters in Texas in general, not just among those who are registering to vote at this moment.
Now, the word abortion is not going to be on the ballot in Texas. So when we have people registering to vote and going to vote concerned about abortion, are they going to see this as a partisan issue? Are there particular politicians that they want to deal with? And when they go vote, like we have a Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, anti-abortion seems to be his main thing. Does he see this as bad news?
I believe so. You know, when you look around the country and you see how candidates of both parties have reacted to the Dobbs decision, you're seeing something interesting happening. You're seeing Democrats talking about the issue more and really finding that they're having more traction with voters and that voters are being engaged by this issue.
Tom Bonnier is the CEO of Target Smart. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. Check out past Texas Matters programs at tpr.org and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.